Hi, I'm Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits. Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome. Episode 46 today.
Welcome to episode 46.
Yes, we have a lot of things to discuss.
Do we?
No. We actually have nothing to discuss. No, we do. We have a good story today. It's a very sad one. This was a rough one, so I'm just forewarning.
I'm ready.
Yeah, and we also have an amazing drink. The drink is
very good.
So good.
I would make it again for show.
Yeah. So we will be bouncing around Georgia today, taking a little walk through Georgia. So you know what that means? Peaches. So we went the peach route again.
Yeah. We like recently did a peach one, so we didn't want to do sort of the same vein.
No, this is different.
Because the last one we did was like peach cobbler. So it was like more like bakery.
Mm-hmm.
Ish. There was some crust flavor in there. Not the case with this one.
No.
So we're calling this one Peachtree Lane.
Yes.
Did I say that?
Yeah.
Oh, this one's called Peachtree Lane.
Did I say
for the
that
third yes. time?
You said that.
Oh my gosh. So first of all, I took a fresh peach that was like pretty ripe, like almost too ripe.
Yeah, but it was perfect.
It was
because you want it to be nice and soft and sweet.
Yeah. So I took that with like 4 ounces of heavy whipping cream and blended it up. And I actually did it in a food processor. Don't do that. Do it in a blender because you need it to be like
very smooth.
Yeah, nothingness because you don't want bits.
We had bits
and then I had to strain it and it didn't strain right. It was just a whole thing.
But it's still delicious. So if you don't have a blender or like a ninja totally. Little thing, just, you know, you do you. But just know that you're going to have to finagle it to get it into the
double triple
glass.
Strain it.
Yeah.
So you take one peach, put that with the whipping cream, you blend it all up, so then you end up with like this peach cream mixture.
Frothy.
And then I also added a little bit of simple syrup just to sweeten it up a little bit more. And then so you take a shaker with ice, you do 4 ounces of plain vodka. I was also thinking vanilla vodka would be good in this.
I think, you know, I thought it would be too much, but now in retrospect, I think it would be delicious.
I think it would be good.
Yeah.
So experiment and let us know how it goes. 4 ounces of peach schnapps, probably 6 tablespoons full of the peach mixture.
Mm-hmm.
I really just like pre-poured that shit in.
You did.
Because it was good.
It was really.
It was good.
It tasted good by itself. I could have just eaten that with a spoon.
Yeah, for real.
So good.
Or like with a granola bar dipped in it. I don't know why that sounds
stop.
So good. Some granola on top.
That sounds so good.
And then also 4 ounces of any brand of white chocolate liqueur. You can use Godiva or what was the one we used?
I can't remember, but it was
Dr. Vans or something, whatever.
Dr. Vans.
Get whatever you need.
Talk
and then
somebody.
1 ounce of fresh lemon juice. And then the you shake over ice and then strain into 2 martini glasses that are rimmed with lemon juice and like orange sanding sugar. Mm-hmm. Like sprinkles that you'd use for
cookies
or anything
something.
Else. And then just a little wedge of peach.
Yeah. And you added the
fresh peach.
And you talked about the simple syrup.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Because I think when we made it, we decided it needed a little extra sweetness.
Yeah, so I initially put just like a touch of simple syrup in with the peach mixture. It does need a little bit more.
Yeah.
So do a little bit more.
I agree.
Do it to your taste.
Yeah, that's what we did.
And you know
it
what?
It was delicious.
After you've already shaken a drink and you've poured it in your glass, if it's not sweet enough, just pour some simple syrup over the top and mix it in.
Yeah.
It's really not a big deal.
No, it's not a big deal. Yeah. This is just cocktails, people.
I know. It's not that serious.
It's not the end of the world.
People might try to make you think it's that serious, but it's really not.
But it's actually really not. That's why we like it, because it's just cocktails. And honestly, it's whatever you like. You mix it how you like it. Because I
right.
think some people might have liked it the non-sweetie way.
Which was... a little bit vodka heavy.
It seemed vodka heavy to me.
Like it was a little bit spicier.
Yeah.
Which if you like hot alcoholic drinks, that's what you would like.
Exactly.
I'm a more of a baby about it.
Are you a baby?
I'm a baby about vodka. I don't know why.
It's from potatoes.
It's from potatoes, people. I just don't. Vodka's not my favorite. Like, I know that people say, like, oh, this is neutral. To me, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, it is neutral in the fact that it will take on the flavors of other things, and that which is a really good thing. But you can still get the spiciness from the vodka,
yes,
for sure.
Vodka definitely has a taste to me.
And I feel like I'm definitely more into gin than vodka.
Yeah, I like a gin.
But this was perfect for, this drink was perfect with vodka, I think.
It's very good. Yeah. I would drink it again any day.
Oh, how about today? It was wonderful. So yeah, thank you for making that. Last weekend, we were on a fun little trip. We went to the ocean and bounced around ocean areas.
We did.
It was really fun. We had tea time.
We heard some ghost stories.
Yes, we did. Allegedly, the hotel.
I should have done that. Why didn't I do that one?
Okay, it's on your list. So allegedly, the hotel that we're staying in the hotel that we stayed in is haunted.
Yes.
And there's a lighthouse in it. And
non-operational lighthouse.
Non-operational. I asked if we go up there. They said no. But then the lady at the front desk was like, oh, I've lived in this town my whole life. I'm going to show you these pictures. So she had the picture of the lighthouse with the light on in it. No, nothing's in the window. And all of a sudden, there is a silhouette of a person in the next picture. And she said, nobody goes up there.
It's like, she said it's like triple locked.
Yeah.
Nobody's allowed up there. And she said she worked at the hotel. She's worked there for a long time.
Yes.
She's not even allowed up there.
It was
creepy. We're like, what? And it was such a weird moment because so random. We just went up there to ask, hey, what do we have to do to get into that lighthouse?
They're like, you can't.
And then this lady comes from the back and she's like, oh, you want to hear about the lighthouse?
Yeah, we're like, always. Yeah.
Hell yeah, we want to hear about this haunted lighthouse. So yeah, she had freaking photographic proof, y'all.
It was, yeah, it really freaked me out. I was like, whoa. And then we were kind of in a wing where no one else was.
Okay.
We were in a secret wing. She said we could run up and down the halls naked. Nobody would see us.
It may or may not have been supposed to be closed down, but they overbooked their hotel and put us on that floor.
Yeah. And so
I remember saying to you, like, our second day there, we haven't run into anybody.
We had ran into nobody. It was deathly quiet, which was fine. But yeah, somebody could have definitely come on that floor and murdered us and no one would have heard. No one would have known.
But I figured we weren't hearing anybody because we're literally on the ocean.
The ocean was loud.
We had the door open the whole time.
It was amazing.
And the ocean was loud as fuck.
It was.
I just figured that's why we didn't hear anything.
Me too. But no. Yeah. Nope. We were ghost fodder.
Which I guess would have been creepy if it hadn't been our last day. If we had heard all that stuff on our first day,
thankfully,
that we were alone over there and that it's haunted.
Yeah.
Then we would have been like, what the fuck?
Murder.
But what would have really been creepy is if we ran into somebody and she said there's nobody else over there.
Okay, yeah. Because then I would have been like, well, but wait a second. I saw someone like literally go into a room and now I'm totally freaked out.
I saw someone in 1700s period dress.
I thought there was just like floating a costume through the party.
No, okay. So then the follow-up to that is there is actually a place there that's like legendarily haunted.
And I think you're going to do that story.
That's nearby. It's not in the place we stayed, but it's nearby.
But I'm excited for that.
So,
and I think it used to be a little bit of a brothel / speakeasy situation.
I think it was wrapped up into the mob situation.
Which I love all those situations.
Yeah. So maybe I'll do that one because the one that I tried to do just fucking sucked. And I hated it, and I will never do it.
You guys will never even know what it is because I'll never do it. I told her to give up. Sometimes you just can't. If you're not feeling the story, you can't.
Oh, my gosh.
You can't do it.
And there's a certain part of the book where they start reading through the autopsy, and that was when they lost me. I'm like, I can't. It was like kids. So kids is already hard for me.
Oh, no, that sounds terrible.
And then and parents. Mm-mm-mm. And I just couldn't. I couldn't.
Maybe I can do the story.
Sure. Yeah. I'll give you the login to my Audible.
Well, and of course, we ended our trip doing what I love to do the most, going to a cemetery. Mm. So we went to the cemetery in San Francisco, and we didn't realize that there was basically six other gigantic cemeteries all attached to it.
So it's in Daly City.
Yeah, it is so fucking awesome. Yeah. Like, if you really are into old cemeteries, I highly suggest going here.
It's really pretty.
We were there for almost 3 hours, I think.
Oh, yeah, we were there for a while.
And we didn't even touch, like, scratch the surface of this place. The mausoleums are bigger than my house. Of one family. Yes. I'm like, this is insane. It's beautiful, though. It is, and there's so many old ones from the 1700s, the 1800s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could have stayed there all day.
And it was really well taken care of, too.
It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. So beautiful. But anyway, we just want to tell you about our little trip before
we did post some of those pictures on Instagram.
That's right. We did.
Yeah.
Go check it out. Killer Spirits Pod.
You got some Instagram page. Really good pictures of, like, statue. Why was I trying to say statuaries?
I don't know.
Statues.
Yeah.
As part of, like, yeah, and gravestones and, yeah.
It was beautiful.
That was a good day.
So that's our vacations. We really just enjoy, like, ghost chasing and.
We're so creepy.
Going to cemeteries. I loved it, though.
Yeah,
it was fun. Drink wine and we did drink tea.
We did.
So that equals
and
everything.
And we ate tea food.
And we ate tea food, which was amazing.
Which is not the same as regular food.
No, and so if anyone out there who understands tea time, you'll understand what we're saying.
Like high, like English tea.
And if you don't understand, it's fine. We can teach you. Just let us know. We could do a whole episode on tea time.
Yeah, we need to do like a, there has to be some tea murder.
Some tea murder. There probably is. All right, are you actually ready to get started on this?
Ooh, and then instead of doing a cocktail, we could do a full English tea.
Yeah, there you go. We just like to do things because we enjoy them.
Yeah, so we can get what we really want out of this. As you may have guessed by listening to a few episodes of the Killer Spirits podcast, we look up some pretty questionable information online. Without context, some of our interests could appear pretty suspicious. That's why we use Surfshark, the VPN service we trust.
With Surfshark, you can protect your online identity and keep you and your family's online activity private at all times. Surfshark can offer the assurance you need that you are browsing privately with encryption so no one can track or steal your data, including hackers, companies, or bots. Their strict no-logs policy ensures that even Surfshark can't track you. They don't keep any record of your online activity. You can change your IP address to hide your location to avoid tracking.
With the S-Alert feature, Surfshark gives real-time alerts when your emails and passwords are at risk of being hacked. And with their Clean Web feature, you can surf the web with no annoying ads, trackers, malware, or phishing attempts.
One of the most unique things about Surfshark is that you can protect your family on an unlimited amount of devices for a super low price, and they have 24/7 customer support. Follow the link in the description to support the show and sign up for Surfshark today at prices starting as low as $2.49 a month.
That is a seriously incredible deal for a little extra safety and security for you and your family.
Agreed. Go check them out in the link in the description. Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
We're jumping in.
We're done with the giggling.
So, this one, again, I'm just going to do a little warning again that this involves sexual assault, rape, all of those terrible things. So if this is not for you, I just want to let you know from the jump. So you're not listening and you're like, whoa, I've been sideswiped here.
Yeah.
So this is the horrific murder of Donna Marie Dixon. And one of my sources was crimedetective.com, which is a really fantastic website created by Jason Lucky Morrow, who is a historical crime detective.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's actually a really good site. I encourage you to go check it out. I'm definitely going to take a crack at some of the cases that he's discussed in one of his books that I got.
Oh, okay.
He really likes to do more obscure and forgotten crime cases.
Love it.
Not the same ones. I listened to him on another podcast. Of course, if you want to come talk to us, that'd be great. but I did listen to him on another podcast, and he was saying that he just got tired of hearing the same things over and over, which I totally get, because I feel like these stories are so important to be told and remembered also.
And I also feel like, I mean, I know there's like the prominent serial killers. We all know who they are.
Right, and they're interesting to listen to.
We're probably never going to do them on our show.
We probably won't.
Because they've been done to death.
They've been
done. No pun intended.
And also, they've probably been done better than I can do.
Oh, totally.
You know, so
a thousand times.
Yeah. And so if you're really into like Ted Bundy or something, like I could give you 12 different podcasts.
Watch that did the movie.
Fucking amazing job on it.
Totally.
But yeah, it's probably not going to be
it's not going to be so us. You know.
But I do like to really focus on the more obscure ones.
So I get what he means, that he gets tired of hearing the same ones.
Yeah.
Especially if you're alive and present while it's happening. It's all over the news.
True.
People talk about it nonstop for years.
And years.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Also, I got a lot of information directly from the court transcripts.
Oh, okay.
Which was in very interesting reading.
That's cool. I love court transcripts.
Transcripts. I do too. And it is kind of cool that you can find them online so mm-hmm. easily now. So Donna Marie Dixon was born on November 9th, 1956 in Newport News City, Virginia. Her father's name was James Edward Dixon. And from what I could tell, she was an only child. I could not find the name of her mother.
Hmm.
So her mother and her father divorced at one point, and she did have a stepfather. And I'm actually going to say it was quite frustrating doing research because there's not a lot about Donna growing up. There's not a lot about her life before this tragedy.
Hmm.
And, you know, I really like to paint a picture of who the person is, and it's very difficult to do that because, you know, this was happened in 1974, and so there's just not a lot out there or who she was as a person. So almost every newspaper from the 70s and 80s basically described her as a runaway from Newport News, Virginia. That was it.
Oh, so what's the...
Yeah, I mean, like, she was a runaway. And if she was a runaway, there's no indication of why. There's no indication of what led up to that. Again, very difficult to find information.
Hmm. And even, she was how old?
Oh, at the time of her death, she was 17. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay, runaway is kind of a loose term at 17.
Yeah, I mean, 17, you're so she wasn't adult. She wasn't little, like 14 or something like that. But in January 1974, she had just turned 17, so newly 17,
mm-hmm.
and she apparently hitchhiked to Atlanta after running away from her parents' home in Virginia. I don't know why. So I will post a picture of her on our Instagram. She literally had the cutest, the sweetest face. Like, I can't even. She had, like, brown hair, freckles all over her face. She was so cute. She looks like she probably had, like, the best giggle on the planet.
Well,
like, she just looks like one of those people. On the evening of January 16th, 1974, Donna and her friend Pamela were in the area of Peachtree and 10th Street in the city of Atlanta, known as, quote unquote, the Strip. I feel like every big city has something called the Strip, don't you? So the Strip was known as a place where runaways would go in Atlanta. And it was not a safe place to be. Sleazy motels, cheap apartments, dive bars, that sort of thing. So a crime magazine later reported, quote, literally thousands of runaway teenagers find a home among the dubious denizens of the Strip. It is nearly impossible to walk in the streets for the clusters of the unwashed and non-working, most of them young and most of them looking for a victim or a handout. So it's...
Was that just like the 70s, y'all?
I did also read that it was kind of a place where like the quote-unquote hippies hung out for a long time.
Okay.
And then I think it just was, it's just a seedy area.
Okay.
It's just not a good area. So while Donna and Pamela were in the restaurant, they were allegedly, now I'm going to say allegedly sometimes because, again, there's a lot of mystery around some of this. And this is some of the witness accounts they got, some from the perpetrator. But it's, we don't know some of this stuff.
Okay.
So
conjecture.
Some of it is, yeah. So allegedly, they were approached by a man named Leroy who invited them to a bar for a beer. So he was like, "Bow chicka wow wow, here's some hot chicas. I want to look. Come with me for a beer."
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, "Fine." They accepted, but they were not really into this Leroy guy. So while they were at the bar, they struck up a conversation with two black men. Well, Leroy was pissed off. He left the bar feeling rejected, and later, the girls went to another bar on the Strip where, lo and behold, this Leroy character follows them. So Leroy apparently met up with his friend by the name of Timothy Wesley McCorkadale, who everyone called Wes. So he was tall. He was 21 years old. He was from Alma, Georgia. He had like a slight build, so he was skinny.
Mm-hmm.
He had a full head of stringy blonde hair that covered his ears. So he had long hair. Like he was, you know.
The 70s
of
guy.
That time. Yeah, yeah, I guess that's what I would say. So His girlfriend, Bonnie Sucra Johnson, had just left from her job at another bar and met them there. So the story goes that Leroy had his poor little feelings hurt because he was rejected.
Right.
And so his buddy Wes decided to, quote unquote, defend his honor by accusing Donna of stealing $50 from Leroy. Now, why he picked on Donna and not Pamela is still a mystery to me, listening to this or, you know, reading about the story. I don't know. It's so unclear.
Is this, like, I'm guessing this sequence of events is from the killer.
Yes, and okay. Witnesses, like his girlfriend and some other people.
Okay.
Okay. And also Pamela, she was there.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. So, yes, there's some corroborating stuff, like stories around mm-hmm. this, but it's still really mucky. When, like, as I'm telling the story, you're going to be like, what?
Like, because, like, the why is not there.
Yeah, the why, it's just so odd. It's, everything is very odd. So Donna, of course, denied this. She did not steal any money, but he continued to berate her. And at one point, Bonnie was instructed to take her to the ladies' room and search her for the money. Like, in her bra and everything.
Okay.
Okay. Now, as I was reading this, I was like, oh, my God, how could Donna just do, like, allow that? But also, she was only 17. She was basically a baby. She was very far from home. She was in an area of town that was not the greatest. And these were very aggressive people.
Sure, she was scared.
She was scared.
And she's like, yeah, no, I didn't steal anything. Don't do anything to me. I'll prove it.
Exactly. And so I think that's what was going on here. So Bonnie found no money, so Wes accused her of giving this phantom $50 to one of the black men that she'd been speaking to earlier.
Why wouldn't she give it to Pamela?
Right? I don't know why. But as we'll learn as we go along, Wes McCorkadale, Timothy, mm-hmm. is racist as fuck.
Okay.
And so that's going to really tie into a lot of this. And so they were just really bent out of shape that she was talking to these black men. Like, it's so fucking stupid.
So they were just coming up with anything.
It's not. And I think really at the point, it wasn't just that you rejected Leroy person. It was that you rejected me to talk to black men.
Okay.
Yeah. So there is this anger and this entitlement in this whole situation. So again, I'm not sure why Pamela stayed behind later, but just the fact that 17-year-olds were, like, basically hanging out in nightclubs and bars is kind of mind-boggling anyway. Mm-hmm. But again, it's the 70s, which were wild, man. And also, it's, you know, seedy time, seedy place. So these three assholes, Leroy, Bonnie, and Wes, somehow got Donna out of this bar, and while standing outside, Wes continues to accuse and berate her, yelling racist insults at her for speaking to black men. Then they all caught a taxi together and went to Bonnie's apartment and arrived there shortly after midnight. So now they're in a taxi and she's left this whole area with witnesses, and now this is, the shit's going to happen.
Never let them take you to a second location.
I know.
Literally run for your life.
Literally run. Never, yeah. I mean, this is just a learning experience for everyone.
Yeah.
It's better to be shot than to be taken to the next location. Yes. Always. So Wes and Bonnie lived together in an apartment in the 1700 block of Moreland Avenue, which they shared with her 3-year-old daughter by another man, and a female roommate named Linda Deering, who was 8 months pregnant at the time. So here's Donna at this apartment, and Wes continues to accuse her of stealing this $50, and she continues to deny it.
Which is like, let it go, dude. She doesn't have it.
Yeah, but that's not the point. That's not the point of this.
Right.
You know, he knows there was no $50. So pregnant Linda soon joins them in the living room, and there is apparently some conversation between Wes and Leroy that Donna should be taught a lesson. And honestly, again, there's no $50. This is all about rejection.
And racism.
And racism. Yes, it's all tied together. So he keeps grilling her and grilling her. Donna is sobbing and telling him she did not steal anything. So basically Wes is like, rubbing her back and saying, I'm so sorry. I actually didn't mean to upset you. You're so pretty, yada, yada, and then punches her in the face.
What?
Yeah, I think he was trying to, like, get her defenses down.
She's already defenseless.
I know. She's already defenseless. So what are you even doing? He's just playing mind games at this point.
He's just a piece of shit.
Oh, he's beyond a piece of shit. So Wes and Leroy begin to slap, punch, and hit her as they got her down to the floor.
Oh, my God.
And then when Donna was able to stand up, Wes grabbed her by her blouse, ripping it off, and then proceeded to remove her bra and tie her hands behind her back with a nylon stocking. He then removed his belt, which was fastened with a large buckle, and repeatedly struck her across the back with the buckle end of the belt.
Oh, my God.
He then took off all her clothing and bound her mouth with tape and a washcloth. And Leroy then kicked Donna, and she fell to the floor. Okay, it's going to get wicked, guys. I'm just telling you. It's going to get really fucking wicked.
Where are the women in this scenario?
Oh, isn't that funny? La, 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 la. Oh, wow. Look what's going on.
Wow.
Yeah. So Wes then took his cigarette and burned Donna on the breasts, the thigh, and the navel. He then bit one of her nipples, and she began to bleed. He asked for a razor blade and then sliced the other nipple. He then asked for a box of salt and poured it into the wounds that he'd made on her breasts. Oh, and here's fucking Bonnie. Oh, you need a razor blade? Sure thing, sweetie. Oh, you need some salt now, my king? Let me grab that for you.
Ew.
Disgusting. Disgusting.
That's horrible.
But also, like, can you have her keep it down? Because, you know, I don't want to wake my 3-year-old daughter who's sleeping in the next room.
Yeah, you're, like, literally in the living room.
Yeah, and it's an apartment, so you know this is not a big place.
And people are probably hearing you from next door. How could they not?
So Linda, who was 8 months pregnant, became ill and went to the bedroom and closed the door. Oh, I'm so sorry, Linda. Are you fucking ill?
Yeah, I'd be fucking ill.
Sorry, bitch. Like, I bet you're ill. How about you think about how Donna's feeling?
Oh, no kidding.
So Wes thought it would be a grand idea at this point to light a candle and proceeded to drip hot wax over Donna's body. I haven't even gotten to the bad shit yet.
Oh, my God.
So he held the candle about a half an inch from her vagina and dripped the hot wax into that part of her body because he is a literal devil.
Yeah.
He then used a pair of surgical scissors to cut around her clitoris.
What?
Yeah, I told you I hadn't even gotten to the bad part.
Okay.
Yeah. So while she's bleeding from her nose and her vagina, Leroy basically forced her to perform oral sex on him while Wes raped her. Now, interestingly, I got most of this from the court reports. And the court reports were like, while Wes had intercourse with her. And I'm like, no, that's not. I mean, I know what you're saying, but that's rape. Like, they made it sound so, like, benign when I was reading it. So I changed that.
Yeah.
So then Leroy raped her while Wes forced his penis in her mouth. So then Wes found a hard plastic bottle, which was about 5 inches in height, and placed an antiseptic solution in it, forcing this bottle into her vagina and squirted this solution in her to get rid of evidence. I don't know what the fuck. I mean, this is the 70s. We didn't have DNA back then.
Yeah.
But they could test other things. Anyway, she was then permitted to go to the bathroom to get, quote unquote, cleaned up. And while she was in the bathroom, Wes found a piece of nylon rope and told Bonnie and her roommate that he was going to, quote, kill the girl. You know, just a regular Thursday activity at this apartment, apparently.
Well, I mean, at this point, you're probably going to have to because there's no way that you could go through all that and then not say anything, right?
I can't even imagine the port.
I mean, you're getting reported.
It is mind-boggling to me. Like, I actually feel nauseous right now just thinking of these two women sitting there being like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
What the hell?
With your 3-year-old sleeping.
With your 3-year-old sleeping. Yeah. Didn't even bat an eye. Didn't even care that you actually have a daughter.
So then that just makes me think that they've done this before.
Right? That's what I mean. It just seems too weird. This isn't the first time.
This isn't the first time.
Another mystery because they're not connected to anything else ever.
And also, you're his girlfriend.
Exactly.
It's not just a guy that you know. It's not just like your roommate.
Yep.
You're in a relationship with this person who's doing this.
She's not even batting an eye.
Not the first time.
So Wes, being the prick that he is, hid in a closet across the hall from the bathroom. And when Donna came out of the bathroom, he wrapped the nylon cord around her neck. As Wes tried to strangle her, the cord cut into his hands and Donna, of course, fell to the floor. He fell on top of her and began to strangle her with his bare hands. Because, you know, the rope hurt him.
Right.
Didn't want that. So he removed his hands and then she began to convulse. So she was losing her oxygen.
Yeah.
He again strangled her and then he pulled her head up and forward to break her neck, which he did successfully. Yeah. And I read some things where he like also just banged her head multiple times on the floor to assist with the neck breaking. So he covered her body with a sheet. And by this time it was about 6 a.m. on the morning of January 17th. Now Wes had to figure out how to remove her body from the apartment.
Got anybody finding out?
Yeah. They found a cardboard trunk, which once contained the toys and clothes of Bonnie's little daughter.
Nice.
Yeah. To get Donna inside this small box, because it wasn't big, Wes had to stomp down on her arms and legs to break her bones.
Oh, God.
When witness Linda Deering later told police what it sounded like, she said, quote, it was like you had taken a big stick and jumped on it. A cracking sound.
Hey, Linda, why don't you shut the fuck up?
Why don't you go fuck yourself into death? I no words, no words.
Yeah. Why don't you just not compare? Just don't.
It's like speechless.
Yeah.
So after Donna's body was placed in the trunk, it was placed in the closet behind the curtain. So this closet apparently had no door. It was like a curtain hanging over it, which also sounds very fucking 70s to me. I mean, it didn't have beaded curtains, I guess, but it was just a curtain.
Yeah.
Wes and Leroy then went to sleep on the couch in the living room. Oh, they're just so worn out.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, for the greater portion of the day, leaving the apartment sometime later that afternoon.
While the three-year-old's just toddling around or doing whatever it is.
Yes. While the three-year-old is just being a three-year-old.
Cool.
Yep. So shortly after 8 p.m., Wes arrived at the apartment with a person named Larry. I don't know who the fuck Larry is either. The fact that, you know, I know people make jokes about, ha ha, if you call me and you need to move the body, I'll show up. But like, no, dude. If you murder someone for no reason, I'm not helping you move the body.
No.
It's just not happening.
You better call Larry, not Tracy.
If you murdered someone for a really good reason, like self-defense and your life was at risk, I might help you move the body. But not in this situation, okay, Larry? No. Larry can go fuck himself too. So as they attempted to move the trunk from the closet, blood began spilling from the trunk onto the living room floor.
Of course. Yeah.
So Wes placed a towel under the trunk to absorb the blood as they carried the trunk to Larry's car. What a great friend Larry is. You can even use my car, man.
Oh, my God. People are, like, watching them carry it down the stairs to the car.
Yeah. You know they were. How could you not? They're in an apartment building.
Yeah.
So when Wes
and there's no internet.
And there's no internet. So what are people doing?
People have nothing else to do besides watch their neighbors.
They're looking out the window.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So when McCorkadale, Wes, mm-hmm. and Larry returned to the apartment, they told Linda that the body had been dumped out of the trunk into a road and that the trunk was placed under some boxes in, like, Dempsey dumpster or something. Like, they put the trunk that she's in, not right. the trunk of the car.
Yeah, yeah.
I kept confusing myself. So just an interesting side note, though. Wes McCorkadale was discharged from the Marines in 1971 for bad conduct. And I have no idea what that was. It was just a little blip that I found, but there's definitely a dark history here with him. Mm-hmm. And in 1971, he would have been 18. So he wouldn't have even been in the Marines that long.
Mm-mm.
So I wonder what happened there. Obviously, he was already a shitstorm waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Or he'd already done things like you said.
Yeah.
And he's just not connected to them. Later that night, on the outskirts of Atlanta in Clayton County, a police officer on his routine patrol spotted what looked like trash dumped on the shoulder of Slate Road and Highway 42. And illegal dumping was a common occurrence. It still is, people. Just fucking cut it out. just spend the $20 and go to the dump. Okay.
No kidding.
In his line of work, he was used to that. So he stopped to check it out. And when he walked around to the side of the road and took out his flashlight, the large pale object had legs, arms, breasts, and a head. So it was not trash.
Yeah.
The body was that of a girl who looked as if she had been tortured to death. So the officer radioed back to headquarters for assistance and, of course, started securing the scene. Mm-hmm. And her face looked distorted. It was barely recognizable. You couldn't, like, if you looked at her face after this beating, you could not even tell that it was Donna Marie Dixon. Her nose was flattened, and she was covered in purplish bruises with severe swelling that pushed everything out of position.
Yeah.
So long, thin welts on her thighs indicated that she had been whipped. Small, round scorch marks over her torso and breast. Red hot candle wax had been poured on her stomach, inner thighs, and between her legs. And when she was thrown out of the car, her body fell on its side with her arms and legs protruding out in abnormal directions, which was because they'd been broken to fit in the trunk.
Right.
So the officer found a good tire track by the road just waiting for a plaster of Paris cast, like, you idiots. So it's not like they're the highest level criminals here.
No.
So next to her body was a bloodstained portion of a cardboard box with black tape wrapped around it. And what looked like fibers, possibly carpet fibers, adhered to the tape. Again, not the sharpest murderers on the bunch, fucking idiots.
Yeah.
Which is good, because it's going to help them get caught.
Good.
So at this point, police didn't have much to go on. There was no local missing person reports for a 5'4" girl with brunette hair, weighing about 140 pounds. And I'm sorry, that's the other thing. I read so many things that called her plump. 140 pounds is not plump.
No, that's little.
She tiny.
Yeah.
Like, what are you guys talking about? The fucking 70s, man. Like, if you're not twiggy, you're plump.
I guess.
Like, what is happening? Fuck off. Okay.
But they're probably used to, like, not related to her being plump, but related to the officers looking for missing persons. They're probably used to all those runaways.
Right. They are.
Like, they're not local kids.
No. So Clayton County investigators worked off the assumption that she was one of these runaways in Atlanta. On Saturday, 2 days after Donna's body was found, a confidential informant working for Sheriff Earl Lee, that sounds so from the South, I love it, of nearby Douglas County provided investigators with two names that could possibly be tied to her death. One was a young woman in her 20s known as, quote-unquote, Bonnie, while the other was a man known as Wes or West. They weren't sure which.
How did they get those names?
I don't know. Confidential informant.
Oh, like maybe somebody was talking about it.
Yes. Yeah. Hmm. You know, your CI, you can't give that up.
That's true.
You got to protect that person.
Maybe their CI was Linda.
I doubt it.
I doubt it.
Fucking bitch.
Maybe their CI was a three-year-old.
Maybe. So, again, they had Bonnie or Wes or West. Mm-hmm. They weren't sure which. So both of these people were known to frequent the Strip. And for Sheriff Lee, his informant was as solid as they come, he said, and had always provided him with good tips in the past. So they believed this person.
And also, she's a bartender, so she's probably well known down there.
Right. Yeah, so they took the CI at his word, and they went to the Strip. So a special squad of Atlanta homicide investigators was formed to investigate the connection to the Strip and the murder, which they were, of course, all familiar with the Strip. I mean, all the drugs hung out there, all the riffraff. So they began a slow, building by building, person by person canvas of the Strip, like old school investigative work.
Dang.
I love it. And it actually didn't take them long to find some people who knew the victim based on their description.
Oh, okay.
So at this point, the police had not identified Donna's body, but they talked to a young couple inside the bar one afternoon, and a teenage girl told the detectives that the victim was most likely a friend of hers who had hitchhiked to Atlanta after running away from her parents' home in Newport News, Virginia. Mm-hmm. Her name was Donna Marie Dixon, and she was just 17 years old. The young girl was asked to identify her friend at the morgue, but she was unable to recognize her. Yikes. That's how bad she was messed up. So Donna's parents were then contacted in Newport News, and they came up and made a positive identification. Her mother and her stepfather. Mm. So as investigators delved deeper into this case, they realized there were apparently a lot of Bonnies just flinging around the strip, apparently. Bonnies everywhere.
Yeah.
But the information they had about Bonnie with a West or Wes did help narrow it down, and it did eventually lead them to Bonnie Sucra. Sucra. I'm not sure how you say it. She sucks, so I'm going to go Sucra. Johnson and Timothy Wesley McCorkindale. Mm-hmm. So it didn't help McCorkindale that he would often wear the same coat, which was described to detectives by other people.
Perfect.
Like,
idiot. It's basically your uniform.
Exactly. The two Atlanta detectives had actually just left the bar just after learning the names of their suspects, got into their car, and were about to start for the apartment complex when they noticed a blonde, stringy-haired man wearing this jacket just walking along the street.
God, these people really are stupid.
It's so stupid. So they approached him, identified themselves, and demanded to know his name. And he said, "My name's Timothy Wesley McCorkindale." I'm sure he said it just like that.
Yeah.
So during his interrogation, McCorkindale told detectives that Bonnie was his girlfriend, Bonnie Sucra Johnson. He gave police her address and a place of work where she was immediately picked up.
Hey, Timothy, lie.
He's not. He can't. I don't really know. Maybe he did lie, but he just didn't do it very well.
I don't understand how people can do horrible, heinous things. I mean, just ridiculous, unthinkable things. And you can't lie about it for a little while.
Ah, you got
me. I'll never understand that. Never.
I know. Ah, you got me.
It's like you can literally torture someone to death, but lying is too hard.
It's very odd. So back at the apartment on Moreland Avenue, police found Donna's blood in the carpet and on the tiles in the closet where she had at one point tried to hide when she came out of the bathroom.
Yeah.
Or before she went in the bathroom. I'm not sure which. In the dumpsters, they found two white trash bags that contained her clothing, jewelry, purse, and an address book
what
with
the
her
fuck?
Parents' Newport News address written inside.
Oh, my God.
Again, not the
okay,
sharpest.
Okay, bye. Open shut case.
Yeah. Right? So he, of course, McCorkindale, waived his right to counsel, gave a full confession.
Okay.
The statement from his girlfriend, Bonnie, was the one used during his trial. Unfortunately,
he went to trial.
He goes to trial. Hmm. Both Linda and Bonnie were given immunity in exchange for their statements, which literally burns me to death. Those bitches.
I don't feel like their statements are necessary. They should have got all three of them.
Right? I don't either. If you could put me in a fucking time machine right now, go back there and tell them this.
You'd smack the shit out of some people.
Yeah, I would smack some shit out of some people. It just makes
because,
me so
like,
mad.
Because, like, the blood evidence is there. They're, like, corroborating their own story.
Yeah, what's
they
the problem?
Found her stuff in the dumpster at their apartments.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that would be enough.
Also, let's talk about Leroy.
I would be like, hey, Linda, we'll let you only do 10 years in prison. We'll give you a shorter sentence if you roll on these two people. But not immunity.
And I almost feel like, and I don't know if
that's
this
gross.
Still happens, but because it's the 70s, like, you have this heavily pregnant woman, you have this mother. It's like, well, blah, blah, blah.
It's
I don't
bad
know.
For society.
I don't know if that's the case. It's just the feeling
okay,
that I
got. Fine.
And also, Leroy.
Yeah. Who the fuck is Leroy?
He was never identified and never found.
This probably wasn't even his name.
So some people believe this dude never even existed. He was just a made-up fantasy.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Many people believe, again, he was entirely made up. There is actually a legit entire Reddit community that discusses the actual existence of Leroy.
Oh, my God. Is it, like, subreddit, not Leroy?
It's subreddit, yeah.
What is it called?
I can't remember the name. Oh. I'll figure it out.
What about Pamela?
Oh, Pamela will come back in the picture.
But does she just say that Leroy is a thing or not?
Yes.
She says he is.
She says he is.
Hmm.
So this is weird. Does
well,
he exist?
He
does he
be.
Not? Who the fuck knows? I don't know.
Unless her friend Pamela set her up and it wasn't real.
Yeah. But, I don't know. Yeah, it's weird. So did Pamela say Leroy? Like, who's Leroy? Again, if he does exist, I'm with you. I don't think it's his real name.
No.
And also, why is McCorkindale going to be so honest about everything, why didn't he point the finger at this dude immediately?
And also, why is McCorkindale so angry about something that happened to somebody else? That's the other part I don't get.
Yeah.
He wasn't the one rejected, allegedly.
Allegedly. That's why I'm saying, was he the one rejected? But he just didn't want to say that.
Maybe.
See, that's why I don't, this is why there's so much muckety-muck around this.
Like, as a couple, they were trying to take her home, and she rejected them or something.
Right.
I can understand that.
The fact that he murdered her is, that's a yes. We know this. Mm-hmm. But who's Leroy? Is this a person that got away with murder and has just been walking around doing Leroy bullshit? Mm-hmm. We don't know. Weird. It's very, very weird. So
it definitely wouldn't have been his real name.
It just doesn't sound like a real name, does it?
No.
I mean, I know it's someone's real name.
It's someone's real name, but
not his.
I don't know. This doesn't seem right.
No. There's something amiss.
I'll have to check out the subreddit.
So, yeah, I did look it over a little bit, but it gets very wordy.
Okay.
Sometimes I'm like, I get lost in all the words of people and the little offshoots, and you're just like, oh my God, this is too much. So Leroy is going to remain a mystery forever. To this very day, nobody knows if Leroy is a real person. Mm-hmm. If he is, he lucked out because he was never charged or found.
Or maybe he was.
For something else. Never connected. Not for this. Yeah. So on February 6th, 1974, McCorkindale was indicted for first-degree murder, and his trial took place in April in Atlanta. So his defense attorney tried to plead his client guilty. Tried to, right from the jump, he's guilty. We're going to plead guilty.
Yeah, he confessed.
But Judge Osgood William would not accept, saying he could not, under any circumstances, sentence someone to death. So, which is interesting.
Okay.
So Judge William said he was rejecting McCorkindale's guilty plea and forced the case to a jury trial where his punishment would be determined. Judge Williams noted that if McCorkindale was sentenced to death, it would be more beneficial for the higher court to have trial transcripts as well as a decision that came from a jury. So
he was okay with sleeping at night if you sentence somebody to death, but 12 people doing it, that's better.
I don't know. Maybe he felt like that was more of a fair trial, you know? So it's not that he was saying that you could never be sentenced to death. He was just saying, I'm not just going to like sentence you on the jump.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And there might be some weird legalese in there that I don't understand. So in his opening arguments, McCorkindale's defense attorney told the jurors, quote, we've been trying to plead guilty for 2 days. Ladies and gentlemen, we're guilty. It's that simple. We don't deny that the witnesses are what the witnesses are going to say. So that was his opening argument.
Okay. Well, a bunch of people in Georgia are going to definitely give you the death penalty.
Oh, well, yeah.
Sorry.
So during the trial, Richard Devon wrote an article in Official Detective Stories magazine, which those used to be a thing. I wish they still were a thing, that stated, quote, the jury of 6 men and 6 women grew paler and paler as they listened to the medical man testify.
They have to be sitting there thinking, like, why the fuck are we here? Why do I have to sit through this? Like, it's guilty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In truth, the evidence was enough to turn the stomach of any normal person. And numerous spectators sickened left the courtroom. Much of the evidence is unprintable.
That's bad.
It was a terrible trial these people had to listen to. So during
traumatized.
So during the trial, of course, Bonnie and fucking Linda testified against him because they got immunity, which again, they did not deserve, blah, blah, blah. So Assistant District Attorney Melvin England stopped Bonnie's testimony at one point to ask her a question. Mm-hmm. Quote, back up just a minute. Let me ask you. At the time the defendant put the cord around Donna's neck, did she say anything? Just as calm as could be, Bonnie told the court, yes. Quote, she said, oh my God, he's going to kill me. She literally said it like super calm and flat like that too. So during the 2-day trial, the jurors were disgusted by Bonnie and Linda's witness accounts, but also how calm and unemotional they were. No affect. No emotion.
I just don't understand how they're both like that.
Right? It's weird. So they showed no remorse for what happened to Donna, nothing. Later on, Bonnie told the jury about the phone call she received at work from Linda. On the day that the body was moved, Linda called Bonnie and informed her, quote, that Donna's body was smelling up the apartment and to tell Wes to come get it. Like it was just a piece of trash. What is wrong with these people?
They must have done some shit like this before.
That's what I mean. I agree with you.
They had to have.
It's too weird. And so were they sloppy like this before and just got away with it? Like, who knows?
Maybe they were less sloppy. Maybe they got sloppy.
Maybe. Linda was also tasked during this time period where Donna was in the trunk in the closet with keeping Bonnie's 3-year-old daughter away from this cardboard box, which was, again, shoved in this closet that had a cloth curtain, not even a door. So that little girl could have just gone in there.
Maybe she did.
Yeah. Just kind of reminds me of the freaking unicorn killer. Remember that idiot?
Oh, yeah. When it, like, seeped through the floor.
Yes, and he kept her in the trunk for
a really long time.
Like, years.
Ew. I
hate that guy. Okay, and this is disgusting, okay? Defense counsel's closing argument indirectly suggested to the jury that Donna had willingly engaged in sadomasochistic activities with McCorkadale and that Bonnie's testimony was not credible. He then went on to say, quote, yes, he killed her. The evidence points to that, and the state says that. We're going to get into some of this later on. Come right to the gut of it. He's guilty of the crime of murder. Maybe he's guilty and the judge is going to charge you murder. Maybe he's guilty of manslaughter. The judge is going to charge you that it has to be done with malice aforethought. You'll decide if it's malice or not. That's an issue I can't decide for you. Try in your mind to ascertain what you believe happened out there, and I think you'll find him guilty. Thank you.
Yeah, I can imagine what I would ascertain.
What are you even saying here?
Nothing. He's like saying nothing.
You're not... Okay, you've already said he's guilty, but now you're trying to give a defense that she was willing? Like, what is going on? It makes zero sense to me.
Throw confusion into the mix?
I don't know.
He's guilty of the murder. It's just in what way he murdered her. With what intention did he murder her?
So, like, it's okay that we're admitting that he murdered her, but we will not admit that he raped her. Because that's just going too far, people.
Right.
Really? Okay. So after a 97-minute deliberation, which is not long, as someone who's been on a jury knows, Timothy Wesley McCorkadale was convicted on April 12th and sentenced to death. In December of 1974, the Georgia Supreme Court denied his appeal. Good. Goodbye. Good. Goodbye. However, McCorkadale, along with all other death row inmates, were granted an indefinite stay of execution by governor and presidential candidate Jimmy Carter as the death penalty issue was revisited by the United States Supreme Court in 1976. It's a cyclical thing we do all the fucking time. Law. Okay. So however you feel about the death penalty or not, I'm not going to get into that. I mean, I respect our listeners on however they feel. I'm still fully straddling the fence. So I have nothing to say about it.
I don't straddle the fence so much, but I can respect other people's
opinions. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So McCorkadale's execution date was continually put off until the 1980s. McCorkadale was in prison with another idiot that we've talked about. You've talked about April in one of our episodes by the name of Carl Isaacs.
What?
Carl was, of course, known for killing the 6 members of the Ned Aldi family in 1973.
That's right.
So in May of 1980, McCorkadale and 3 other Georgia death row inmates, including Isaacs, wrote a letter to the president, Jimmy Carter, with an offer to go on a military mission to rescue the 52 American hostages held by Iran at that time.
Okay, bye.
Yes.
What a stupid idea.
Those dumbasses. So Carl Isaacs wrote the letter that stated, quote, all 4 of us have discussed this proposition, and we would rather go to our graves fighting for our country than sitting here and rotting in this hell.
Shut the fuck up, Carl.
Are you kidding me right now?
Oh, so now you're so noble and honorable?
Let's go fight for our country. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So although their letter was published in newspapers, President Jimmy Carter never wrote back. Good for you, Jimmy.
Yeah, no.
He's First of all, whatever, dumbasses.
The letters you write to the president are not getting to his desk, okay?
Never. They never do.
Never. Mm-mm. Mail does not get delivered to the president's office.
Okay? They don't get delivered to your governor either. As someone who works in that arena, I will tell you, it never makes it
there.
They
never get anywhere.
No.
Unless you can get the person face-to-face, they're not hearing from
you. There's about 30,000 layers between that letter and the person you're trying to get it to.
How about just tell them your opinion with your vote?
Yeah. So Isaacs, this was just another one of his publicity stunts. The three other prisoners that were to accompany him on their secret mission, on this secret mission, were, of course, McCorkadale, Troy Gregg, and Johnny L. Johnson, which we're going to talk a little bit more about these dumbasses too. So two and a half months later, on July 28th, 1980, McCorkadale, Gregg, Johnson, and another inmate by the name of David A. Jarrell escaped from a maximum security prison in Ridesville, Georgia. There were over 2,000 prisoners at this prison. This is just so wild, guys. Okay, again, the 70s were wild. I just can't even imagine this happening today. Using hacksaw blades smuggled into prison with the approval of a corrupt guard, because there's always a corrupt guard.
Yes.
The four death row inmates sawed through the bottom bars of their cell doors. So the Tuscaloosa News reported on July 29th, which was the day after they escaped, how interesting it was that none of the guards ever heard this sawing, because that's going to be loud as fuck.
What I always think is funny about that is, like, why would you give them a hacksaw blade when you could just pop the door?
Yeah, right. Like, you're going to be...
dude, if you're going to do it, just open the door. It's a one-second action.
But maybe he could, like, remove himself from the situation if you just gave him the tools.
Oh, like if he wasn't working that day or something?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Like, okay. I'm not involved in this? I don't know.
Just leave the door open.
Just leave the door open. So, anyway, the paper's like, why didn't anyone else hear this? This constant sawing, right?
Was it thundering? Like, no, in there Shawshank?
Well, okay, yeah. I mean, that's kind of smart, but... There was a new industrial fan that had been installed, so maybe that was why.
Okay.
What the fuck? So at 6 a.m.,
so dumb.
They scrambled through a window in an exercise room and just walked out of the prison wearing retailored pajamas, dyed black and made to look like guard uniforms.
Sure.
They were stopped at the main gate, but they told the guards they had security checks to conduct. And these are definitely not pajamas, guys. These are bona fide.
And they're all together. Wait, did they believe it?
And they were like, okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Apparently, there were some patches that were on there, too. I don't know.
Okay. And they were all in on it.
Yes. The accessories and patches sewn into the PJs came from this corrupt guard that was also selling drugs to prisoners. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, they just sauntered right out of there. And I also read that McCorkadale's mother hid a car near the prison that they used. Mm-hmm. So, good job, mama. Like, how about some self-reflection on why your kid is in prison like that?
No kidding.
I mean, and even so, I'm not saying it's...
Do we have her story anywhere?
No, but I'm not saying it's a parent's fault, per se, when their child grows up to be a monster.
But it is when you help them escape prison.
But that part is.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so through... The thought process at the time was that they escaped to avoid their impending transfer to death row at the Georgia Diagnostic Classification Center at Jackson, where the conditions were much more harsh and it would have been much harder to escape.
No industrial fans.
Yes, because the state's electric chair had been transferred there a month before. So they were getting ready.
So they have to follow the electric chair.
Or the death row, because death row was a thing again.
Yeah.
So they were opening things up. So 1 hour later... After this escape, Gregg telephoned Albany Herald newspaperman by the name of Charles Postal, which is such a great name, and told him of their escape and said, dude, we're in Jacksonville, Florida. And so he's like, okay. So at 10:27, Postal called Deputy Commissioner Colonel William Lowe to inform him of this escape. But no one believed him.
What?
No one believed him. He even told this William Lowe, Colonel Winlow, told Postal that everyone's accounted for and in their cells. So relax, dude. I don't know what the fuck you're calling me for.
Maybe and you should do another count.
Lowe later told reporters this was the first time he'd ever heard about it when Postal called. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah. So the Associated Press reported, quote, their flight from the fourth floor cells was so well executed that more than an hour after Postal informed prison officials of this news tip, the escape had not been confirmed. Postal later said, quote, the real story is that it took me 4 hours to convince anyone they were not up in their cells.
Why couldn't they just walk up there and look?
Who knows? I don't know.
So dumb.
Yeah, so he also described the inmates as a racist clique who frequently boasted of their crimes and hostile encounters with black inmates inside the prison, which kind of ties all this together. Mm-hmm. But he was a complete racist. He also said they were all violent and desperate, and he was certain that they would hurt someone else. So Postal was like, get on it, guys.
Yeah.
Like, this is not cool.
These guys are on the loose. I think it's funny that they called to say they were out.
Yeah, they're like, hey. They're probably like, where's our story, man?
Yeah, do you want to interview us?
Yeah. We're and here. He's like, wait, what?
Fuck.
And the prison's actually denying that you've escaped.
And you're in Florida?
Yeah. So Troy Gregg, one of the escape dudes, was convicted of murdering Fred Edward Simmons and Bob Durwood Moore in order to rob them. He had picked them up for hitchhiking. Johnny L. Johnson was convicted of murder on July 20th, 1974, when he abducted and killed Susan Elaine Edenfield. Jarrell was convicted in December 24th, 1973 for kidnapping and murder of Mala Still. So we're dealing with some true assholes here.
Yeah.
And definitely not good that they're out.
No.
I mean, when you're a death row inmate, no, 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 no.
Especially all of them together.
We do not need you to see the light of day.
No.
You need to stay there.
Yeah.
Three of the prisoners were captured 2 days later inside of a rundown house near the lake in North Carolina following a six-hour standoff with police that included a helicopter and everything, which the 70s, a helicopter, whoa, you get out the big guns.
Yeah.
So the house was owned by William Chains Flamont.
Okay.
Come on. Come on, Chains. Just Flamont is good.
Wait, so Chains was his, like, AKA?
Yeah, because he was a member of the motorcycle gang called the Outlaws.
Oh, my God.
So, of course, your name's going to be Chains.
God, give it a rest. Doesn't mean we just work, like, a regular job?
No, they have way too much fucking time on their hands.
Good Lord.
So, Flamont said that he was friends with Jarrell, and news reports at the time indicated that McCorkadale may have also been a member of the Outlaws when he murdered Donna, but this is unknown. Okay. He had some affiliation, obviously. So also in the house at the time was James Cecil Butch Home. So it's Chains and Butch.
Yeah.
Who was a close friend of Flamont's.
Okay.
Who also may have been a member of the Outlaws. I mean, there's also a, you know, there's all this murkety murk because it's
like, I know that they want to be taken seriously, but don't be Chains and Butch.
Yeah. Chains and Butch. You know what? If I had a name, I just think Chains would be the most amazing. I'm just going to go with it. Just call me Chain Link.
Just a little Chain
just
Link.
Just a little Chain Link. Yeah. So although police wouldn't say what tipped them off, before the standoff, they did retrieve Greg's body.
What?
From a nearby reservoir.
Oh, of course they
killed
each other.
So one of the dudes is dead.
Of course they kill each other.
Yep. Flamont told police a fight erupted between the prisoners and Greg was beaten to death. And later reports indicated McCorkadale was the key individual behind his death.
That makes sense.
Later, during a preliminary hearing for Butch, another witness testified, quote, that McCorkadale knocked Greg down and began stomping him. He said McCorkadale, who is 6'3" tall and weighs about 300 pounds, so he was not a small guy.
Oh, yeah, he was big.
Yeah, he was like a scrappy little dude with long hair, but I guess prison, like,
beefed him
grew him up or something. He picked up his right foot and stomped down with all his weight several times on Greg's upper chest, throat, and head.
Yikes.
Butch Home then pushed McCorkadale off and stomped on Greg himself, the witness said in court.
Okay.
So in spite of all this, officials chose not to charge McCorkadale or Butch with the murder of Greg. So they're like, oh, well, wow. What? So what are you thinking? Like, oh, it's just, you know, the death penalty happened earlier than we thought.
Oh.
I don't know.
I didn't think about that.
I'm just saying, I don't know why.
I was just thinking like, well, it's part of the deal.
It's part of the deal.
You guys escaped together.
Yeah.
We're not surprised.
You put yourself in that situation, I guess.
Yeah.
Who knows? But you're right. There's no honor among thieves. But and these guys had no honor at all.
Oh my gosh. I didn't really think about the, you just took death row matters into your own hands.
Pretty much. After the prisoners were returned, 11 individuals were indicted for helping the four death row inmates escape. This included McCorkadale's mother and aunt, who investigators said sent him the hacksaw blades concealed inside the handle of a portable radio. Nice. So maybe he got them from the guard. Did he get them from the, who knows? There's so many different stories out there. Investigators also reported McCorkadale's mother, Toni Jo Hooper, and aunt Minnie Hunter, visited the prison that day before the escape and left a car with the keys inside, waiting in the parking lot for the four to drive away after their escape.
Toni Joe.
Toni Joe and Minnie. You guys, that's fucked up.
You ladies need to get it together.
Yes. So besides this other prison guard, they did find him, indicted him. They also indicted Charles Postal and his wife.
What?
The guy who called the commissioner and said, hey, my dude.
How the fuck is he in trouble?
No. Yeah, they indicted Charles Postal's wife, who they said purchased these hacksaw blades.
What?
Yeah. Listen, though. Postal denied these charges with the declaration that Georgia authorities were trying to get revenge on him for publicly embarrassing them.
Okay. So they're trying to put together the story that Toni Jo and Aunt Minnie met up with Postal so Postal could buy hacksaw blades at the hardware store, give them to Mama Jo and Aunt Minnie, and then put them into a portable radio and send them in, and then the guys called Postal when they got out.
But also, didn't they say the guard gave the I mean, how many hacksaws are we talking about here?
What is the real
hacksaws
fucking
coming
story?
Out of their ass?
Don't put the hacksaws in your ass.
No hacksaws in your ass. Okay.
This is like...
I don't understand.
Postal had to have been so confused.
Well, Postal was pissed. And also, the hardware store attendant, whom Georgia investigators claimed sold the hacksaw blades to Postal's wife, could not remember the purchase at all. So they're like, we don't even know what you're talking about.
Of course they couldn't.
Because it probably never happened.
Oh, maybe. Or if it did happen, like, you see a million people. Like, you're going to remember one guy that bought hacksaw blades at a hardware store. People probably buy hacksaw blades all the time.
Yeah, so Postal's boss, who was Albany Herald, told reporters on August 28th that we are inclined to view it all as harassment and revenge. So he was finally released on $5,000 bail. But he said certain law enforcement agencies got egg on their faces.
Kidding.
And I think they were trying to divert attention.
I have a question about Albany Herald.
Yeah.
Is that a person's name?
No. I think it's the name of the newspaper.
Okay.
The Albany Herald. Gotcha. It's just called Albany/Herald. Yeah.
I was going to say, because that is a very good newspaper name.
It is a good newspaper name. Yeah. So that was the name of the newspaper.
Huh.
I mean, it makes no sense that Postal was involved to me.
No.
I mean, if the hacksaw blades were smuggled in a portable radio purchased by McCorkadale's family, why would someone else also purchase hacksaw blades coming at your ass? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't.
I mean, where are you even hiding these hacksaw blades in your cell?
I mean, anywhere.
I don't know.
They have little creases and crevices and all their stuff.
They're just shoving in places. So McCorkadale's appeals dragged on for 7 more years.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Besides alleged errors made during his 1974 trial, McCorkadale's various appeals claim that he told a state psychiatrist in 1976 who believed him that he could not even remember this murder.
Okay,
he could not remember murdering Donna.
Okay, bye. Yeah, that was like our last one. I don't give a fuck about your amnesia. It still happened.
Yeah, I don't care about your amnesia, man.
Really don't care.
Don't. It doesn't make it go away.
Nope.
Yep. I cannot believe, this is Timothy McCorkadale says, quote, I cannot believe that I would do them things. I just don't believe I could do it. Well, I believe it, Timothy.
I believe it. A full confession and pled guilty in court.
Yeah, but all of a sudden you have amnesia?
You just can't believe it.
I like how I've been waving my arms around so much during this episode. I'm just like, blah, blah, blah. But it's just so frustrating. It's like, what are you doing? So allegedly, in the year leading up to his execution, this is just going to, you're going to be so surprised by this, April. Mm-hmm. McCorkadale, by then in his mid-30s, found God.
Oh, that's exactly what I was going to say.
You knew it.
Yep, he's saved.
Oh, yeah. He's been saved. He wrote a letter to the state pardon and parole board. The board chairman then told reporters, quote, He does show considerable remorse for what he has done. Okay, I'm getting too excited. I'm over-talking myself. He does show considerable remorse for what he's done.
Does that make a difference? Do we care?
I don't. And also, it was too late.
Yeah.
It was way too late. So on Monday, September 21st, 1987, he would be led to the electric chair. Now, Amy Wallace from the LA Times wrote an article in 1990, which seems like 1,000,000,000 years ago, but it detailed her experience witnessing the execution. And it's a really good article to read. I did pull some of the information from that, so I do highly suggest reading
it. So she was there reporting on it?
She was told to go there and report on it. And she actually dives a little bit deeper into, the death penalty itself. And kind of the whole, thing around that. But, it's a good article. You could just Google it and find it. So about 7 p.m. on September 21st, 1987, two guards led Timothy Wesley McCorkadale through a red door and into the small death chamber at the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Center. The electric chair was made from sturdy Georgia pine and had been built by inmates, per usual, it seems. Mm-hmm. You're going to build your own prisons, and you're also going to build your own electric chairs. There was no single executioner. To spare any individual the job of killing, the state had divided each electrocution into dozens of tasks, and prison employees were asked to volunteer for just one. On this day, dozens of people would perform the many rituals that altogether would lead to his death.
But somebody's got to pull the lever, right?
Somebody's. Multiple somebody's.
Oh.
So okay. His requested last meal was boiled shrimp, crab legs, and tossed salad with Thousand Island dressing and apple pie a la mode. I'm always very interested in the last meals.
I gotta say tossed salad. I like that.
That's what it said. The salad was tossed.
I don't like it.
Yes, it was tossed. Oh, my God, you're killing me. So another prison official had tape-recorded a private statement that would be stored in the prison archives, and the prison barber had shaved his head. Mm. Now, allegedly, there was a recording of this execution that is no longer available online. But at one point, there was a link that linked to it.
It would have been, because I've briefly read this part, it would have been sick and disgusting.
Well, duh. And
irritating as fuck.
I'm sure it would have been.
Yeah.
Six guards surrounded him. They fastened 10 leather straps around his body, cinching them tight. The guards exited, and a prison electrician attached two electrodes to wet sponges at the top of his head and on his right ankle. McCorkadale was asked for his last words. He smiled and gave a thumbs up.
This is why it would have been fucking annoying as fuck.
Yep. Then he said, quote, I would like to tell my dad and everybody with him I love them very much. Stay strong in Christ. Okay.
All right.
Guards pulled a chin strap tight to hold his head steady. Then they tied a leather mask over his face, hiding his eyes. The prison chaplain said a prayer. Then, of course, gave his little arm a reassuring squeeze. Sorry, my man, you're about ready to die.
Yep, that's it for you.
And left him alone in the chamber. As McCorkadale waited for the charge, you could see his mask moving with his breath. This is what Amy said.
Gross.
She wrote a really good article.
Yeah.
It really helped me visualize this. So at 7:15 p.m., three volunteers pushed three buttons, only one of which activated the electrocution device. And they've been doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years.
It's like a firing squad.
Yep. You don't know who did the kill shot.
Right.
The charge hit McCorkadale, and despite the leather straps, threw him back in the chair. His chest contracted, his body tightened, and his fists began to redden. After 4 seconds, the voltage automatically decreased from 2,000 to 1,200 volts. And after 8 more seconds, decreased again to 220 volts. After exactly 2 minutes, the generator shut off automatically. Then began a 6-minute, quote-unquote, cool-down period, and during which McCorkadale's body fluids were allowed to settle and return to their normal temperature, because he would have been, like, really heated up.
Yeah, gross.
He was pronounced dead at 7:23 and was the 5th man to be executed that year in Georgia. So they were stringing him through.
Yeah. I mean, after a moratorium, I would think,
yeah,
that they would get back to it.
Yeah. So a statement written by Donna's friend, Pamela, as well as Lauren, Susie, and Rick, these are her friends, I'm going to read it. Quote, Donna Marie Dixon was a sweet, loving girl. Her loves in life were food. You ate what Mama fixed. Favorite food was food.
What?
I think they're just trying to say that she loved all foods.
Okay.
Her favorite song was Stairway to Heaven. Flowers were mums. Birds were cardinals. And her goal in life was to work with animals. Pam, her best friend, moved back to Newport News after the crime. Imagine how traumatic to be asked to identify your friend, but don't even recognize her. There is not a day that goes by that she doesn't think about Donna Marie Dixon. She wants the world to know that Leroy, or Lee, does exist, and she saw him get into the cab with Wes, Bonnie, and Donna. We are looking for some pictures of Donna to add to the web, and hopefully someone out there knows new information about this case. We need justice for Donna. Gone way too soon. R.I.P. So according to Donna's friends, an Atlantic detective is looking into the old files of this case in order to learn the true identity of Leroy. It would be very interesting if we could figure out someday.
Or Lee,
who this is. And just the fact that she shortened his name makes me feel like she obviously saw him or heard his name.
Or was spoken. Familiar with him.
Right.
At some point.
So who is this person? So Donna Marie Dixon is buried at Green Lawn Memorial Park in Newport News City, Virginia, USA. And that is the story of the horrific murder of Donna Marie Dixon.
I don't have much to say.
There isn't really much to say. It's a horrific story.
Besides, I fucking hate that guy.
I'm really glad she got justice.
I agree.
And except for Bonnie and Linda.
Yeah, fuck those bitches.
I hope that your children grow up to be good people. That's all I'm going to say.
I agree, I feel like they did.
I hope they did.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know how you could with growing up with a people like that.
I don't know. Yeah.
It's disgusting. I hope that for your kids' sake.
Yeah.
They don't ever know what happened.
That, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's a rough one, man. I didn't like that one at all. So, thank you for making a lovely drink today to counteract the shit.
I feel like we had to laugh through that one.
I know. It was very bad, I told you.
And funny that Carl Isaacs came up.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Because he was like, a sick fuck, too.
He was a sick fuck. And all those sick fucks got together, and then they become more sick.
And then they murder each other. So stupid.
It's like Lord of the Flies or something.
It really is.
It's crazy.
Yeah. They're just a little bit older.
Yeah.
They're still boys, just old.
Well, you guys, thank you so much for listening. You want to tell them where to find us?
Yes. If you would like to email us, hit us up at killerspiritspod@gmail.com. We're on Patreon at patreon.com/KillerSpiritsPod. That is where we post our drink tutorial videos. Also, if you're a Patreon member, you will be getting our recipe book for free.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, I'm going to send it to you. I haven't totally figured out how to publish it yet, but
I'm excited for our recipe books. Like, I'm going to have it at the bar ready to go.
Yes, and it'll have good full color pictures.
Gonna be great.
Yeah, easy to peruse.
I love it.
Where else? You can find us on Instagram at Killer Spirits Pod. We're on Etsy if you'd like to buy any of our merchandise to help support the show. Just look for the shop Killer Spirits Pod. And I think that's That's it.
Yeah, and make sure you follow us for our continued ghost adventures, cemetery adventures,
yes,
and murder and mayhem.
Yeah. Oh, and we're also going on a an evening cemetery tour.
It's going to be dark. Lantern tour.
Lantern tour. So this is next month in October. So we'll report back on
that. Yeah, we'll definitely post some photos to our Insta.
It'll be spooky for sure.
We love you guys.
Okay, bye.
Bye.